Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 24th, 2001. In the Creekside room this afternoon is Bill Hutchinson. Today's session number is HUB 2001-02 and is titled, What Materials and Tools Do We Need? Let's listen in with Bill's class.
This is going to be to get us together here.
Now the boat's going to list to the one side. Sometimes that happens on a small attendance. Everybody's on one side and feel like you're going to. So let's begin. I'm Bill Hutchison. I'm at Light of Christ Lutheran Church, along with another colleague, Beverly Conway, in the north end of Chicago. And it's a new congregation, almost 2 years old, created from two previous congregations coming together. And so it's been a kind of a project of joining two things. And I do woodworking on the side as an avocation. And so I thought this would be a fun thing to do, of looking at woodworking as a kind of metaphor for ministry. And looking at it all under the rubric of building God's kingdom. And so if it's not a perfect metaphor, it's just something that's a work in progress as a way of getting at some of the things that we do in ministry. And when I say we, I don't mean just ordained folk, I mean all of us together. Or, conversely, if we're more comfortable in this realm, it gives us an opportunity to dabble into something that's a little more tangible. I think you're familiar with this verse by now, the one that we're using as the theme for the summer, called by name. And I'll make reference to a few other verses as we go along. When we talk, today we're going to talk about materials and tools. Yesterday we talked about framing references, and we talked about framing references with respect to woodworking, things like dimension. We didn't get into some of the highfalutin things like moisture content of the wood and those sorts of things. But we did talk about square, triangle. We talked a little bit about rough versus finished carpentry and so forth. We talked about need. There's a certain need that dictates a frame of reference. And similarly, we could talk about those kinds of things in respect to ministry. We have need of some kind. We have a context in which you're doing the ministry. We have material as people. And today we're going to talk a little bit more about that. And we have models of what it might mean to be church. And I talked briefly about Avery Dulles's book, Models of the Church. And he talks about three basic models. Not that these are exhaustive, but that these are at least three to consider: family, servant, and herald. And we talked about how one of the two churches that came together in this consolidation, now called Light of Christ, had clearly seen themselves as a family model church, and realized that while that has some close relationships built into it, there are limitations because there's a kind of maintenance mentality that sets in rather than an outreach and inviting others in. And my friend Tom Farrell was the one that led us through a half-day council workshop to look at those models. And right away, the council wanted to go on to the servant model. And he helped encourage us to think even farther about the herald model, which incorporates the relational qualities of family, but also the outreach qualities of a servant model. And rather than going just for a servant model, we might be whole hog into a social justice kind of ministry as a congregation, to go on to a proclamation ministry where there's this this relational, evangelical inviting in to the community, into the discipling community. And all of that by way of building God's kingdom. And it's not us who build it, it's really the Spirit, God, who builds God's kingdom, but it's we who participate in that. And we can certainly do things to thwart building God's kingdom. We can certainly put obstacles in the way, and at the same time we can put ourselves into the task to help further along. I wanted to talk a little bit at first about materials and tools in woodworking, because that's fairly easy for us to imagine and to think about. And we might have an easy time imagining tools and materials over here, but I'm not going to assume that for right now. So I'm going to start over here. What are some tools that come to mind in woodworking? First of all, how many of you have had actual woodworking experience of some sort?
Limited.
Some, or at least some interest in it. What are some tools that you're familiar with?
Saw,
okay.
Chisel.
Chisel, sure.
Plane.
Router.
Welcome. You got your Bible with you today, or did you want to pick one up off the table? Some other tools that come to mind.
Sander,
okay.
To fix all of them.
A hammer?
Sure.
The inevitable persuader.
Lathe,
okay. And if we were to start to group some of these, there's at least, if we were to reduce it down, there's three ways of giving shape to wood. And one is splitting. Let me try to spell this right. And you can think of a wedge, and what you're doing is you're parting the grain. So you're going in line with the grain. And so splitting would work with chisel, would work with plane. And that's probably it for right now, although in some senses the router is doing some splitting and it's doing some cutting. That's the next thing here. And with cutting, you're actually severing through the grains that are intact. So you're doing everything but going, well, you can even be going in line with the grain, but that's technically called ripping, which is a specialized form of parting the grain in line. The tool is running in line with the grain. So ripping, and I'll put it over here as a subcategory. And so obviously the saw goes with cutting, and the lathe is doing some cutting. We have a tool that you're resting on a tool rest, and the object is spinning in such a way that the tool is introduced into the material and creates a cutting action against the wood. Then the last kind of is what I'm calling rubbing. This is a very technical word. Sander. And sometimes there are scrapers. Now I'm not familiar with using scrapers, but there are these things called Swedish scrapers that it's a flat piece of steel with a slight curve to it. And you can use it to really smooth the grain, almost like honing the edge of a knife, only it's the reverse action. The blade is honing the surface of the material rather than the leather strop honing the edge of the blades. It's that same kind of idea where you hold it at an angle and you sweep it across the material of wood in such a way that it knocks down the grain. And especially when you're coming against the grain, it flicks off those little hairs of the wood that stick up. So I'm going to call it a scraper, and I don't know if that's the technical name, but it's a sort of a scraping blade, which would also be with rubbing. And then we know, of course, that there are different sizes of tools in each of these categories. We have different grains of sandpaper, you have different speeds of rubbing the sandpaper over the surface of the wood, you have different curves that you can work with, different pressures that you can introduce. And with the saw, you have different speeds, different size blades, different angles that you can cut, all sorts of things. The router also would be with cutting. The various shapes of the blade can create different shapes along which the router is passed. Hammer, this is not a real common way of doing woodworking. But pounding to create an interesting effect. It's more in metalwork where you have a beaten surface with the ball peen hammer. But sometimes you can introduce a distressed look into the project, or you can use it, obviously, for fitting. When you're doing joint work, and you need to bring pieces of wood as close together as possible. There's different kinds of wood, and I just brought along a tiny little scrap of wood that my son had found, and it's got a nice display of the annular rings, and some of you may have heard of rift wood or quarter sawn wood, and maybe aren't exactly clear what that is. It's kind of interesting. Regular sawing of logs at the mill is going through, and there's a certain pattern that they use to maximize the wood that they get out of the log and to minimize the number of turns and so forth. And it's maybe something like this, where they make it through several passes. And on these pieces, you'll get the annular growth rings fairly even. But on all these other ones, you'll get that spalting, where you have the curve of the oak and the waviness. And sometimes it's very regular, but sometimes it has these disappearing parts up and down. You can kind of see it on the wood in here. Here it's very even grain, and in some other places you'll see this kind of thing where it has these curves, and that's where the grain, the rings are coming up out of the plane of the wood, and that's why you see these dips. And here the grain continues on, so it depends on how parallel the board is cut to the actual growth of the tree. And of course we know that all trees don't grow straight, so sometimes there might be a section of the wood where it's parallel to the growth rings, and other times the tree bends, and so it starts to then have these ring spalting curves and so forth. Quarter sawn is a much less efficient way of cutting the wood. What you do in quarter sawn is you cut all of your pieces as much as possible radially to the log. And you can see right away that you don't get as long, as wide boards, and you get waste in these corners, and so on. And then you get very even graining, and especially with woods like oak, it's a nice, more evenly stained, and it doesn't have quite as crazy a grain pattern. And for some applications, it's preferred to have quarter sawn wood because it just gives it a slightly dressier quality. These are all things by way of material. Personally, I like to use different kinds of woods where the natural color of the wood lends itself to variety in the piece. I do use some stains, but my preference is to let the natural colors of the wood speak for themselves. And some of the most interesting colors are some of the more tropical trees, like amaranth. That's a wood that has a heartwood called purple heart that's similar to the color of the covers on these Bibles. And it's a great wood for religious objects, for processional crosses and so forth, because it speaks of Christ's passion. It will bleed over time with sun, so you need to use a blocking UV blocker on it so that it doesn't tend to go out to pink. Not a true pink, but more like a sort of a lavendery pink. And unless you want that effect, but it's not something that you can control. And the more exposed to sunlight, the more pinkish it gets. Kind of like cherry wood, which goes the other way and tends to start out a very light orange and then tends to get darker with exposure to the sun and get more of a brownish orange or a burnt sienna kind of color. Ebony is very, very dear. And so it's often used for highlighting and detailing. When I say dear, I mean it's on the order of 10 to 12 times as expensive as walnut per board foot. And that also tends to come in smaller chunks. You know, it's very unusual to find a large piece of ebony. And if you did find a large piece of ebony, it will crack and split and check very easily. And they tend to wax the boards while they're in storage just to keep the moisture content inside. It's tricky to work with. As you know, ebony is very dense. It's very close-grained. You really have to have your sharp tool sharpened to be able to cut through it without fighting the wood through the saw. What else can we say about materials? There's also another kind of tool is the design that we're using. And certain woods tend to splinter more easily, and so certain joints are less easily done in certain kinds of wood. And so you want to have your design working with the material that you have things working well together. Your joint layout themselves. Depending on the project, you might want the joints to be visible, and therefore you want them to be a little bit dressier. Otherwise, you might want to minimize the joints. You notice around the window casings here that they have a miter joint, which just gives it a nice, slightly dressier quality, but without going into tons of work. Sometimes in older homes, you'll see the bullseyes at the tops of the door frames, and that's a very simple thing. They just create the bullseye, and then they run the board's butt joints up to each of those sides of the square bullseye. Sometimes you'll get into drawer joinery where you have dovetail joints, and sometimes they're fully blind, half blind, or more exposed, and that all depends on the effect that you're trying to achieve. Time is actually a material when it comes to a project. There's only so much of it that we all have, and we have to build that into the equation of how we are able to work through the project. Conversely, another way of saying it is, in order to do a job right, it takes a certain amount of time. That's one of the reasons why probably more of us don't do not just woodworking, but music, sculpture, pottery, all sorts of things that just simply take time. You know, if you're going to work with sculpture, you got to take time to work the clay to get it to a working temperature and moisture content. Then, once you've done that hour or so, or half hour or so, then you can actually start working the material, and then you have to allow for drying time and so forth. Basketry, you have to soak your materials. Weaving, you've got to set up your loom, you know, and so forth. There's just a lot of time in getting set up. Let's talk about some materials and tools in ministry. And maybe there's some stimulation of our imaginations that's happened here, but think about things that we need to do ministry. And I'm talking about ministry in its broadest context, in its most largest purpose of building up God's kingdom. What are some things that come to mind?
Time,
absolutely. And often I think we just want to rush this. I don't want to speak for other pastors, but I know myself, I find myself getting impatient at times because the idea seems so clear, but the ownership of multiple people in on the project takes time for that all to sift its way through. Yes?
People. And almost a substructure specific talent.
Yes. Talents or gifts that they bring. Absolutely.
I got a fly that I'm going to get. He just will not be.
I think we sat in here all day.
Did you get it? Other tools and materials that come to mind for ministry?
Some knowledge.
Knowledge. And I'm going to expand that slightly to training because we can have people who may have some gifts and talents that might not be as appropriate or maybe as fine-tuned for what we're trying to do, and they acquire knowledge or training so that their gifts can be expanded to be more applicable to what we're trying to do. You could come up with lots of examples of that. One example might be counseling. We might have somebody who's a good basic listener, but they need to embellish or train in furthering their listening skills and learning to look for certain things in particular arenas of counseling. And so then that might be an example where they are even better in that ministry of counseling through training than they would be without it. Other materials or tools that we can think of for ministry?
Well, the fundamental one is the scripture.
I was hoping somebody would say that. The word, scripture.
That's shorthand for scripture, is not Schustafel. How about prayer? I don't know if we think of that as a tool very often, but it's certainly available for us. And this is something that I know we're taught about in seminary, we're taught about in confirmation, we're taught about in Sunday school, but until we actually use it, and I don't mean exploit it in that sense of using it, but use it as in practice it, I'm not sure we really know the power of prayer in terms of its ability to bring about change in our lives, both personally as well as communally. In this consolidation process, there was a lot of prayer involved. Selling two churches, closing two congregations, bringing it all together, buying a new property, all very risky things, and it involved a lot of prayer and discernment.
Well, isn't the place a tool?
Place?
Sure. Or building?
We might call that more broadly context. There are certain things about a context that lend itself to certain kinds of things more easily. Sure.
I'm thinking of a lot of qualities that are needed in both sides. Qualities like some courage.
Okay.
And patience. And qualities.
Courage, patience.
Yeah. In how you approach things.
Maybe some creativity. There are going to be inevitably, I can speak from some of my own experience, you try and plan ahead buying your wood, and I found that it's best to buy slightly more than you think you're going to need, but even still, there are times where you sort of discover something about the piece of wood that you brought home, and it turns out to be faulty or inadequate for the job. Maybe there's a split that you didn't see, or there's a knot that you looked for and you didn't see it until you get it home. And rather than running back to the wood shop or to the lumber yard, what I've decided to do is that for certain processional crosses, especially where there's a lot of light and it needs to stand out, and the sheen and the casting and the figuring on the wood is significant. It's subtle, but it's significant. I will rather reduce and redo the dimensions to fit the wood that I have rather than just throw in another piece. And there's something for me about one or two pieces of wood, you know, say it's a piece of mahogany and a piece of maple. There's something to me about the integrity of the design and the integrity of the wood all come from the same piece. And I, you know, maybe that's just me playing around.
That's another of those qualities I was thinking of trying to land on is appreciation for what's inside.
Internal aesthetics or?
It's the ability to see the spirit of what's inside.
Hmm.
Or to work with that.
So, would we call that the internal spirit?
Well, what you said just to suggests something to me that you have to work with less than perfect materials.
That's right. That's right.
And so you have to use what you have, and as a you're not going to have all PhDs in your pews or your committees. You use what's there.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. And believe me, if I were to go into a confessional mode for a moment here, during this consolidation process, there were many times where I would say to myself, gosh, if only we had an, you know, attorney and whatever already in the congregation, we'd be, you know, 15 yards farther down the road than we are because we don't. And yet I learned this, that it's far better to use what's there and add to it as you go, rather than trying to say what's there isn't good enough and we have to bring in something totally other.
Well, I just remember so well our first parish. We had this one congregation, the largest of the three, was to call it blue collar is to overstate. Very uneducated, very limited in their experience, and very down on themselves.
Okay.
Very unsure, they tended to think of themselves as not much of anything. And it was really something to watch over a period of 6 years, that congregation with these folks actually becoming a model for the neighboring congregations who couldn't understand how we could do the things that we did.
Hmm. That's a beautiful testimony.
Yeah, and they are still a remarkable bunch of people.
Yeah. And it's partly being trained, but it's also partly prayer and the power of the Spirit to empower people.
Well, building them up is what.
Yep. Building up. Absolutely. That is a tool. It takes time, but it's a very powerful tool, because it's like that old adage, catch me a fish, I eat for a day, teach me to fish, and I eat for a lifetime. Build up somebody, and it takes a while, but it means that they're there for the long haul, and that congregation, that community, that discipling community is going to be able to go much farther in its ministry than if it were just done by a few folks running around wearing 15 hats trying to do it all. Some other tools that might not be readily apparent: consultant. Now this is not to negate what I said earlier about using what we've already said earlier about using what's there and building up and training talents that are already there, but there are times where a consultant is a real helpful tool, because for example, in our consolidation process, we had two churches equally struggling, and to have any one person from within trying to facilitate the process would already have set up people with different sets of baggage. If the person were from the one congregation, it's the sense that, oh, this is really moving in our sort of direct favor, and the other congregation feeling, oh, well, this is easy for that person to do because they're from that other congregation. Whereas with a consultant, they bring a fresh perspective, a fresh set of eyes, a fresh set of questions, and they don't have this sense of loyalty or beholdenness to either of the parties. Also, they often bring in a different skill set because they've worked with other situations, and so they can be farther along the learning curve without having to stumble along through the first time with this group. Strategizing is a tool, and I don't want to sound like some kind of junior CEO type here, but sometimes I think in the church we don't plan out far enough ahead. We don't think long range enough. And strategizing can be done on a short-term basis, 1 to 2 to 3 years out. It can also be done on a 5 to 10 year basis, and ideally it's 10 to 20 years out. And it's not to create a written in stone plan, it's to sort of anticipate and ask questions about what's ahead in such a way that people can begin to see that what happens now fits into a larger scheme of what's going to happen down the road. I want to take a look at the, we talked about gifts and talents, and I just wanted to remind us about the parable of the talents in Matthew 25. I'll just take a quick look at that. Matthew 25, 14 through 30. And would anyone care to read that for us?
For it is as if a man going on a journey summoned his slave and entrusted his property to them. To the one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, each according to his ability. Then he went away. The one who had received the 5 talents went off at once and traded with them and made 5 more talents. In the same way, the one who had 2 talents made 2 more talents. But the one who had received the 1 talent went off and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those slaves came and settled accounts with them. Then the one who had received the 5 talents came forward bringing 5 more talents, saying, Master, you handed to me 5 talents. See, I have made 5 more talents. And his master said to him, Well done, good and trustworthy slave. You have been trustworthy in a few things, I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. And the one with 2 talents also came forward, saying, Master, you handed over to me 2 talents. See, I have made 2 more talents. His master said to him, Well done, good and trustworthy slave. You have been trustworthy in a few things, I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. Then the one who had received the 1 talent also came forward, saying, Master, I knew that you were a harsh man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you did not scatter seed. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. But you have what is yours. Here you have what is yours. But his master replied, You wicked and lazy slave. You knew, did you, that I reap where I do not sow and gather where I did not scatter. Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and on my return I would have received what was my own with interest. So take the talent from and give them to the one with 10 talents. For to all those who have, more will be given, and they will have an abundance. But from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away. As for this worthless slave, throw him into the outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth.
Thank you.
Amen. The gospel of the Lord.
Which is always tricky to say after that gnashing of teeth. It just doesn't quite feel satisfactory, but it's there nonetheless.
Yeah, it ain't fair.
I want to suggest that we've been talking about talents and gifts, and we've been talking about prayer, we've been talking about, I've said it, discernment, but I haven't written it up here. I want to suggest that there are talents and gifts that are already known, and that there are also talents and gifts which have not yet surfaced. And I'm going to suggest that for ourselves as individuals, and I'm going to suggest that for our communities of faith in which ministry is happening. And that one of the tools of ministry is to keep asking the question, what are the gifts that we bring? And trying to dig a little bit. One example from my own personal life is my dad died 14 years ago, and my mother had this basement full of tools that my dad, being a physician, was able to afford expensive hobbies and play toys. And she said, you know, they're sitting here collecting dust. Can you use them? And I happened to be in a parsonage where there was a basement big enough to accommodate the tools, and I said, sure, I'll be glad to. And we were in Chicago, and the tools were back in Pennsylvania, so I took them around the truck, brought them back. And then I thought to myself, now what am I going to do with them? Because I loved woodworking, but I didn't have any, you know, purpose. I didn't have any particular thing that I was doing. Went to a retreat center. They had just redone the chapel from the year before when I was there with confirmation retreat. And it was the old cobwebby, dingy, dusty, summer-only kind of place. And they had totally redone it into a carpeted, air-conditioned, painted, sort of almost like a yuppie chapel out in the middle of this woods. And everything was nice except for there were no cross. And I was just sort of struck by the fact that they would go through all of that and not have a cross anywhere in this chapel. And so my mind just right away started kind of going into a processional cross that would be able to be moved around, and they had the room such that you could move the altar and the chairs and so forth and set up different configurations. And without knowing it, I got myself into a woodworking project, talking with the camp director, and he said, oh yeah, we're thinking about doing that, but we just haven't gotten that far along. Why, do you have any ideas? And I said, well, yeah. And so I started drawing, and he said, well, that looks good. Let's go ahead with it. So the long and short of it is, that was where I started, was seeing something that I could do, and all these creative juices came rolling out that were kind of interesting. And the cross I came up with, just as an example of where this is going, Rod, you may have seen this up at Lutherdale, if you've been up there, in the Bakken Chapel. And there's this cross up there that kind of has the designs. I'm not drawing very well, but anyway. And there are a bunch of nails that come around in here, and then there's more oak in here. And these pieces are purple. Purple wood. This is a black ring with these masonry nails to come in to create a crown of thorns effect. And it's ringed by a light colored oak. And then there are the arms of the cross going out there, oak with a sliver of ebony right down the middle of each of those. And the idea is death and resurrection. And there is no cross. There's nothing that's actually crossing like a typical cross would have. And it's the idea of death being swallowed up and the resurrection being kind of burst open. And seeing the world through the cross. That's kind of the imagery that came to mind. Because they had these windows where the cross would be sitting in front of the windows looking out at trees, and I just couldn't see putting a cross in front of the windows that you couldn't see through. So it was like blocking the view. Anyway, the point I'm trying to make is, it's only as we dig and have opportunities and challenges that we are presented with that we discover some of those talents that are lurking. And this parable that we just read, one way of reading this is that this man going on a journey was testing his slaves to discern what kinds of talents they really had. Now clearly he had an idea that there were differing talents and differing skill levels according to the way he gives 5 and 2 and 1, but he also was surprised. Because he clearly expected even the one who was given one talent to do something more than what they did. And was clearly pleased by the fact that the person who was given 5 talents and the person who was given 2 talents managed to do something significant with both of those amounts of talents. And I really think when we look at the community, we were talking about using what's there. There's more there than we recognize. And sometimes our immediate assumption is that we need to have, you know, expert in the legal area, an attorney, expert in the financial area, an accountant or a CPA, expert in the teaching area, expert in, you know, so we start going expert, 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 rather than recognizing that there are more ways to get to where we need to go with people who have talents that are not readily apparent. And now how do we inculcate that sense of discerning the gifts? I really think we have to continue to invite and continue to encourage people to, I hate to use that phrase, but it says what I wanted to say, and that's follow their bliss. The idea that there's some yearning inside of each of us, whether it's a creative urge, whether it's an urge for order, whether it's an urge for deeper spiritual understandings, whether it's an urge for relationship in terms of the way they're parenting and so forth, whether it's an urge to discover a whole new realm with further education, or just trying something totally new, just trying out new things. And until they're given the opportunity or the challenge, we never give them the impetus to rise to the challenge. And I discovered that in this congregation that I was serving. One Polish ex-Catholic who was a member of the congregation described it as a church run by a bunch of German janitors. That was his characterization of it. And I didn't hear that until we were right at the cusp of merging, of consolidating with this other congregation. I was glad I hadn't heard it up until that point. But when he said it, it was like it clicked. I said, yeah, that's a good characterization, but that's what we were. And out of that, we had more there than we would have recognized right off. So another way of looking at the parable of the talents is that maybe there's more there than we sometimes see at first blush. And I think that's true for both ourselves as disciples within the community, as well as the whole community of disciples altogether.
Well, in the case of this one congregation I was describing, they had the view of themselves that there's nothing we can do.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess all we did is simply not pay attention to that. Just gave them things to do and assumed that they would do it. I don't know how discerning we were.
Well, sometimes discernment is persistence.
Yeah.
Following up the possibility and not necessarily thinking about it, but just doing it.
My second parish had another very interesting attitude. I found this out from a congregational president who said, "Pastor, in this congregation, we assume that all the ideas are going to come from the pastor." And I never broke that. I never was able to break through that.
Wow.
They really have been so schooled in the idea that the one who thinks is the preacher.
That must have been an awful challenge for you to try and work past that.
I never succeeded, really. They were wonderful people, but
it's a tremendous burden that they put on you, too, to always look to you for. Just for fun, are there any other thoughts or comments that come to mind at this point? I'm still trying to sort of create a matrix or a metaphor of meaning here between woodworking and ministry in some broad brushstrokes. I want to go one step further and talk more about this discernment and the process by which significant work can be done, both woodworking as well as ministry. And this is somewhat a quick overview of what we did in our consolidation process. And I don't use this as prescriptive, it's just descriptive of how a process can work. For example, in doing woodworking, we have to have some kind of design. And I really want to say designing. Because as we already spoke about, you find something wrong with the wood and you have to kind of alter the design as you go along and recognize that there's some flexibility and some challenge about how you do that. And we obviously have to gather some materials. So I'm going to put up here gathering materials. And in this case, we're talking about wood, but we're also talking about fasteners, we're talking about adhesives, we're talking about finishes that we might want to apply, so I'm going to put up here, et cetera. And then we have to do some cutting. I've yet to walk into a lumber yard and see a board that was just the right dimensions for the work that I need to do. Although I do find, and this is going to sound crazy, when I first started woodworking, it was all about the doing, and the cutting, and the sanding, and the joining, and so forth. And the more and more I get into this, I find I spend more time thinking. And it still takes a certain amount of time to do the job, but what it means is I'm thinking about the stuff behind the scenes more, so that as I walk into the lumber yard, I'm already imagining, oh yeah, this piece here, the figuring on this wood, and the length of the board will allow it to be, you know, the two legs or the main creep cross piece across the front of the altar that would really, you know, just look sharp. And so I'm kind of picturing the layout of the wood and the pieces that I'm going to cut out of that wood even as I'm standing there. And I know I must look crazy because I stand there maybe for half an hour looking at two or three boards and measuring and so forth. But it's like going into a fabric store. You've got to find the right bolt of fabric that has the right, plaid or the right print or whatever it is that you're doing. Shaping. Cutting is where you get it to your rough pieces. shaping where you're starting to plane and starting to get the edges smoothed up and so forth. And then you've got some smoothing, planing going along with that. Now, shaping also is if you have any curves or rough overall shapes that need to be introduced that are not linear, you need to get on a bandsaw or hand saw if you're doing it by hand, depending on the detail. Planing. There's some rough sanding sometimes in here, depending. Here's a piece of chalk. Joining, which is a fancy word for putting pieces together. And there's obviously all kinds of joints. You can see there's a miter joint, but then there's a piece of metal running here. It's a spline to reinforce it. Here we've got a butt joint, and it's cheating really because there's no dovetail, no dowel pins or anything. We're using this bracket. And then along the end here, there's a dado joint where there's a groove run in the face of the wood and there's other pieces introduced there so it stays fairly fixed. There's all sorts of joints. And there's finish sanding. And there's finishing. It's putting something on the surface of the wood to protect it. And there's always inevitably touch-ups. Something gets dinged or a certain blemish in the finishing or extra glue that you missed that needs to be pulled out or something. Can we come up with some parallels over here? We've got a
long-range plan.
Long-range plan, okay. And I'm going to put planning, because that's an ongoing thing.
And selecting leaders, people, fit.
Okay.
It's obvious.
Mm-hmm. Identifying leaders.
And I shouldn't use the word leaders, but because that loads it too much.
How about key people?
Yeah.
Okay. We have to do some kind of prioritizing because you can't do it all right away, and some things need to happen before other things can come into place. We
be
have
ready
to
for failure.
Be ready for failure. That's good. Now, you mentioned it with respect to the wood. Imperfections, there are always flaws, inevitably.
Including the breacher.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to put in here parentheses S, be ready for failures. We shouldn't assume there's only going to be one.
Doesn't that suggest there better be a plan B?
There you go. And I'm going to put down alternate plans. Anything else?
Maybe even before the long-range planning, maybe there's a vision, kind of an overall vision.
Okay.
So that helps you. If your vision, if your long-range planning gets off kilter, the vision will help you.
Steer it back.
Plan.
Okay. So that this can fit in with this to the vision and also the prioritizing to some extent. There's also a need to contextualize. You know, what will work in one setting may be totally adiaphora in another setting. So contextualizing, asking the question, how will this work in this setting? We have to have some feedback from the people involved, and I'm going to call it initial feedback. In this consolidation process, in order to get this group and this group to think about moving towards some kind of working together, and initially it wasn't about consolidation, it was just about how do we work together better with two congregations that are within close proximity to each other, both struggling, both having questions of viability. And in order to make it something that was going to work, people in the pew had to feel like it was something that they could take ownership of, something that they could agree with. And so in order to get that, we needed to have initial feedback and at various points along the way. And so it was a kind of a action, reflection, articulate and reevaluate kind of back and forth. At some point, you have to implement it. So implementation. And at some point, you have to evaluate that. And at some point, you have to reform, which is kind of like these touch-ups. Implementation, kind of finishing. It's not a perfect map, but you can see some parallels here. We're gathering together what you need. You're starting to do some prioritization, getting things shaped, finding alternate plans, contextualizing, you know, using what you have, putting it together, implementation and joining, finish sanding, evaluating, touching up, reforming. The idea here is that you have to have a plan, but you also have to evaluate it as you go along. One example in real time with the church addition that I was part of watching happen, but it wasn't something that I did. This was a fellowship hall being added onto a church that had been talking about doing this for 30 years, and finally they got the will and the architect and the money together to put it into action. And in the process of putting this thing together, there were these laminated arch beams that we see in a lot of churches, and there are tremendous side thrusts introduced into these things because of the weight of the roof pushing out on these things, and that gets transferred down to the bottom. And the architect, right in the middle of the job, he was actually on the job site at the time that they were getting ready to pour the floor, decided to do what's called a grade beam. And so what he did is he had them put reinforcement bars running across from side to side that would anchor into the concrete that these would rest on, and then dig a little bit deeper below the floor where the concrete would be poured in there, and it was as if you had a concrete boxed out beam down below the floor that was locked in place because of the reinforcement bars getting locked into the concrete to resist the side forces being transferred out to the bottom points of these arches. And he hadn't designed that into the original design, but he just made a, you know, 5-second decision that this is what was needed. And so as you go along, sometimes you need to introduce something right as you see it at the right step to make sure it's going to work. An example of that in the consolidation process we went through was we knew that we were going to have to somehow get the two churches to see themselves as potentially one church. And what better way to do that than worship together? And now how do you do that without adding extra worships? So we took a very risky step of literally closing the church at one Sunday a month on the one end, putting a sign on the door saying, worship today at St. Mark's is over at Rogers Park Lutheran Church. It happened that they were both at the same time, so that made that easier. And then the next month, on the third Sunday of the month, we would have a sign on Rogers Park Lutheran that says, today worship is over at St. Mark. And we, of course, announced it, made sure everybody in the newsletter knew about it, putting a little map on the door. And it worked, because eventually people stopped sitting on different sides of the aisle and they started to sort of filter into one another. And by doing that for a whole year, the idea was to see, could we live together, first of all, and did it really feel like this was the right thing to do, praying together and discerning along together. Simultaneously, we had joint council meetings.
You had what?
Joint council meetings. That was in addition to our regular council meetings. So you would have your own council meeting from the two churches, and then on the other, you know, you have it once a month. So then 2 weeks later, you would have the joint council meeting of the two councils. So it ended up being two council meetings a month. And again, that worked because we had to learn to make decisions together. it was tricky because we had to do decisions that were only pertinent to our various congregations. We couldn't make decisions for the other congregation, but we could be making them simultaneously and with close cooperation, knowing what the other church was doing. One example of how that came into play was this is kind of along the lines of having to go with what's going on. The January 17th of 1999, we had not yet at that point made a decision to consolidate. I was pastor at one of the churches and got a phone call from the alderman, which is like a city council member for Chicago, as well as a lawyer from the school board of Chicago, all on the same Sunday afternoon, both in their offices, both expecting me to call them back. Well, I don't know about other pastors, but when you get a phone call from a political and a lawyer representing a fairly large political interest on the same Sunday afternoon, it kind of gets your attention. And it turned out that they had heard rumors that we were talking to this other church and might be consolidating, and would we possibly be looking at selling the church? And the reason they were interested is because they wanted to buy that church to be able to start buying other properties to create a large enough plot for a brand new school. And that created a catalyst for us to be very, very intentional. And 7 months later is when we consolidated. We had not made a decision by January 17th of 99, but by August 1st of 99, we were in fact consolidated. So we scrambled. And I, as pastor, took this as a sign from the Spirit that we either were going to get shoved aside or we were going to get serious about being intentionally together. And so we scrambled around to get a plan of consolidation and work it through all the congregational votes and so forth. And we had already been worshiping together for about 6 or 7 months at that point. And so it all came together. But it was one of those things where it was either fish or cut bait. I mean, we had a decision moment to make there. And so rather than seeing it as a threat, we saw it as an opportunity to really further cement the discussion and have a sense of urgency instead of just in the fullness of time, it would be great. I'm going to stop here and ask if there are any questions or other thoughts that come to mind.
Did you end up building a new building, or did you use the other church?
We decided that in our case, it was better to sell both churches so that there was no sense of, you know, one church getting to keep this and the other church having to give up that and so forth. And then we decided to seek a neutral third site that was more visible on a main thoroughfare and had off-street parking. And we were specifically looking for a non-traditional church architecture kind of building. So we looked at office buildings and commercial properties. And we found a two-story office building that had large open secretarial clerical areas along with private offices around the perimeter that worked well for open worship areas as well as Sunday school classrooms and so forth.
How much have you learned about wood itself in doing this? I sense you're really into the use of wood as a medium, but have you grown an appreciation for the wood itself? How it got to be the way that it is?
Yeah, I do. Especially when I'm in the lumber yard and you see the variety, even within the set of maple or in the set of oak or, you know.
Those trees have their own history.
Yep.
In God's creation.
Absolutely.
Which is, good times and bad, kind of like people.
And there are times where I feel guilty because I think, gosh, here I am, you know, taking what's taken 20, 30, 40, 50 years to grow, and I'm going to come in and take 20, 30, 40, 50 hours to, you know, reshape
it and use it for some other purpose.
Yeah. Yes.
If you've already talked about this, I'll talk to you in private. What was your original vision? What made you say, hey, we ought to get together? Can you talk about that?
I didn't today, but I did a little bit yesterday, but it's worth repeating. Some of you know the history of the ELCA with the ALC from the Twin Cities headquarters and the Philadelphia, New York LCA headquarters, and then Missouri with this Missouri Synod, the AELC group that broke away. And Chicago was an interesting case study because there was an overlay of three territorial sets of Lutheran churches that suddenly became ELCA. And so you literally had what were appropriately spaced LCA or ALC churches before. Now that you introduced this ELCA consolidation merger, four blocks, six blocks, eight blocks apart. And if they were all going gangbusters, that would have been one thing, but they weren't. And on the north side of Chicago, there were, well, there still are about two dozen, but at the time there were about 30 to 34 churches from the loop to the northern city limits, from the lake over to the Kennedy Expressway, which is kind of roughly a big pie-shaped wedge. And so 10 of the churches were saying, how can we do things more faithfully? How can we do things better that aren't so redundant and that are more cooperative, where three of those churches were strong enough with endowments and so forth that they could probably make it on their own. Six, seven were not. And the question was, how do we rethink through that? And so that was the initial vision. And then, of course, attrition and so forth worked its way down to literally two of the churches of the 10 closing within the five-year period that this took. The three that could make it on their own staying on their own. And then two others opting out at the last minute, and then finally getting down to the two that remained consolidating. Yes?
In your consolidation, every church over 10 years seems to have relics in the church. How did you incorporate that, or did you even try to incorporate that in the new building, the cross or the original whatever?
The one church was going to be torn down, so we stripped everything we could there, including some of the stained glass. Some of it was not really very religious in presentation, but the stuff that was, we took with us. And in the other church, there were some things that we literally could not take with us just because they were so cumbersome. There's one marble slab, maybe 6 inches deep from Italy, in the shape of an ellipse, on top of two angular legs, and it probably weighs 6, 7, 8 tons. And we decided that was just impossible, not impossible, but just too much. There was an organ, pipe organ, and we decided that that was just an encumbrance to try and bring that along. So the things that we could bring along, we've been very careful about using some of this and some of that as a way of symbolizing coming together. And then we've added new things as well. Maybe there was a little reading desk that was kind of in the closet or in the Sunday school area. Now it's touched up and finished up a little bit more, and now it makes it presentable for worship area. And there was an altar that I put together from a top from another job and some legs that I put on there, and that created that.
Are you going to talk sometime about how you get the, I'm using your analogy, the soft maple and the hard oak to work together? I mean, I teach African American literature, and anytime you've got racial reconciliation the way you obviously do, that's worth celebration. Is that coming up, or hey?
That's a very good question to ask.
How do these German janitors do with the other?
It turns out there were enough of the same mindset in the other church so that neither group felt threatened immediately by, you know, what they were getting into. But at the same time, I have to say that talking about cutting and shaping, a consolidation is a natural breaking point for people who were coming in from the suburbs from a distance, since we're so close to the edge of the northern city limits anyway. People were coming in from nearby suburbs. That was a natural breaking point for them to sort of self-select. And so it's not the case that one membership plus one membership equals two times the membership. It's a case where one and one equals about 1.5 or 1.75. And that, of course, changes as people either are sold or are not sold on the way things seem to be shaping up. And we've always said that our growth is going to be at the edge. It's going to be the new folks that catch the vision and come in, as opposed to the folks that have been there all along. Not that they're not welcome, not that they're not invited, not that they're not challenged, it's just that that's not where the main growth is gonna be. And that's kind of like a tree. The growth is at the edge, where the bark and the xylem and phloem and the annular rings keep going that way. So there's something very organic about that. As far as the joining and the incorporating, one of the ways we're doing that is we have a diverse staff. Intentionally diverse. So my colleague is an African-American woman. The other pastor of the other church had been there 10 years. I had only been there 4.5 years. She had had a really rough go at that other church the first few years, and I think part of that was her being a woman with that mindset of the men kind of running things roughshod on her. And after 10 years, she said, I'm ready for a change. I had only been 4.5 years where I was, and I was ready to keep on going and to see where this would all go. So we took that opportunity to have that second pastor be intentionally called as a woman of color. And, you know, how do you do that without being prejudiced or biased, even if it's in a good way? And the way we did it was we just said to the bishop, you know, do whatever you need to do, but we're going to pass over the names that don't fit a woman, and preferably a woman of color. So basically signaling, don't even bother giving us names that don't fit that criteria. And the bishop heard us loudly and clearly, and so that's how we went. So right away we have a staff, and also the person that they meet when they walk in the front door is an African-American woman who's got a very warm, immediately engaging presence. So right away people walking in recognize that this is not just talk, but it's real substance. We take turns preaching. She has a different style than I. We try and incorporate into our worship life a sense of the spectrum of music. Fortunately, we have some diversity in both congregations that continues into this new consolidation. And we're being intentional about inviting people from the neighborhood who are African American, who are Northern European, who are Hispanic, so forth. It's a challenge, but finally, the joining is in worship. It's through prayer. It's through small groups. It's through learning how to be disciples through various avenues, and it's a process. It's not something we can say, okay, we got it now. We're all done.
That's great.
Well, you guys have been very attentive. We've gone over our time. Thank you very much. And tomorrow we'll be talking about pacing ourselves, both in terms of good working as well as